Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Simone Rios, in for Tiziana Deering. I want to start by reading you something I wrote with great expectations. We put in our first offer, and hopefully it's our last. The final piece is the barn. Our idea is to turn it into a home for my mom so she can be closer to her granddaughter. It's hard to overstate how much this would mean to our family. That's a portion of a letter my family and I wrote 4 years ago when we were house hunting. Spoiler alert, we got the house and we turned the barn into a house for mom. My letter is not unique. Realtors often encourage buyers to write so-called love letters to sellers. The idea is to make themselves stand out in this incredibly competitive housing market. But while the practice isn't new, it's coming under scrutiny as possibly contributing to housing discrimination. Oregon became the first state in the country to ban love letters last year, and now a bill in Rhode Island would do the same thing. Here in Massachusetts, love letters are allowed under state law, but there's been some movement among realtors to discourage the practice. Have you ever written a love letter to a seller for your dream house? What did it say? Or maybe you've received the love letter as a seller. What did they say? Send us a text with your thoughts right now to 617-766-0382 to get started. That's 617-766-0382 by text. With me now is Jonathan De Arujo, a realtor with the Vantage Point team based in Lexington. Also, Ed Fitzgerald, the reporter for the Boston Globe covering Rhode Island. Jonathan, Ed, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Ed, let's start with you. I read a little bit of my love letter just now. But when we say love letter, what exactly is meant by that?
There are letters that prospective home buyers send to provide some personal details, maybe photos of the family to say, love your house. You know, it's got all the passion of a love letter, only the passion is usually for like granite countertops or built-in bookshelves. And you know, they provide photos of the kids and say, I can picture them in the backyard. I one of the letters that someone wrote here in Rhode Island talked about how we walked into your house and we gasped, you know, we were holding back tears when we saw your kitchen. So
I laughed when I read that. Gasped internally, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. One of our colleagues at BUR, Diana Bell, told us that the house she lives in now had been a family home for almost 70 years. And the four kids who grew up there were selling it. And they were mulling over different offers. And Diana did some research and wrote that, you know, this would be our first house, and we'd been hopping around from apartment to apartment for over a decade, and they're looking to put down some roots. And, you know, of course, she got the house. Is this in line with the love letters that you've heard about in your reporting?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and they could be really heartwarming. I think the concern that the legislator here in Rhode Island raised and you saw in Oregon is that they could allow unconscious or even conscious bias mm-hmm. to creep into the home selling process. You know, if the buyer is going to say, oh, that reminds me of me when I was that age. And I talked to some people here in Rhode Island that were selling homes that said, you know, oh, yeah, we had a couple send us a love letter. It was just like us, graduate students looking for their first home. And so it raises the possibility that factors like race, religion, sexual orientation, family status could be part of the decision.
Absolutely.
Rather than just the terms of the purchase.
That's right. And we'll definitely get to that. Jonathan, I want to turn to you now. You're a realtor and you've been in the industry for more than a decade. Do love letters make a difference? And can you think of a client that has used one successfully?
Absolutely. Yeah, they certainly make a difference. I won't say in all cases, but in many cases, they make a difference. And a great example is I had a wonderful lady that I was working with in Medford who had lived in the same home in Medford for over 45 years. And her kids, she had raised her kids there, and her husband had since passed away. She was well into retirement age, and the house was just becoming too much for her. So she wanted to find a condo, but she wanted to be in the same neighborhood that she'd been in for the past almost 5 decades. And we found the perfect place for her. It was a block from her church. So as she was getting older and driving was more challenging, she could walk to church. And it was just the perfect fit for her. And there were, you know, 4 or 5 offers on it. And, you know, being someone who hadn't made any attempt to buy a home, honestly, in her whole life, because I think when she got married, she moved into her husband's house. She was reticent, and she wasn't one of these, I'm going to offer as much as I possibly can. So she wrote this beautiful, and I mean, you know, perfect penmanship, most beautiful letter you've ever seen, just telling her story, how she lived in the area for almost 50 years. She raised her kids in this house. She was downsizing. Her church is right down the street. And the sellers said, you know what, you're not only are you not the highest offer, you're the third highest offer, but we just love your story so much, and we want to help you. We want to help you fulfill this dream. So if you come up halfway and meet us in the middle, we'll accept your offer.
Wow. So they were actually willing to accept less money to sell to the right person.
Take less money. Yeah.
The point I want to get to now is about the kind of the implicit bias that folks are starting to talk about in these love letters. So the basic argument is that they could elicit, you know, unconscious or conscious bias in sellers. We spoke with Maris Bergquist, executive director of the Massachusetts Fair Housing Center. She said only objective terms should be used in determining who gets to buy or rent a space. Basically, can the person pay the bills? And she says love letters are not that.
We know unconscious bias exists. So, for example, if someone were to send what we're calling love letters to a seller, and maybe they'll include a photograph of their family to show how, you know, excited their family is about the house, these photographs can and have triggered conscious and unconscious buyers in the home sales transactions.
So we should note that we did reach out to the Mass Commission Against Discrimination, and they said that they had not gotten any complaints. By the way, that's the state agency that would handle complaints around housing and different types of discrimination. They don't have any record of complaints stemming from love letters. But Ed Fitzgerald, you spoke with realtors in your reporting on Rhode Island's push to ban these love letters. What did they have to say about the potential for bias?
Yeah, I talked to Dino Confalone. He's a past president of the Greater Boston Association of Realtors. And he said, you know, like as you mentioned, there's no law against it, but that love letters are frowned upon because of that possibility of discrimination. He said that, you know, if there are two love letters and the seller chooses one over the other because of race or another factor like that, it's a humongous liability for the realtor. There could be litigation over it. The interesting thing is that out in Oregon, when they passed that law, got challenged on First Amendment grounds. You know, if I want to tell you I have cute kids and I like your kitchen, that's my First Amendment right, is the argument. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out on the legal front.
And did you see any sort of evidence of discrimination or people just kind of raising the possibility that discrimination could happen because of these love letters?
Well, there was here in Rhode Island, there was a hearing on the bill that would outlaw it. And one of the people that spoke up said, yeah, I just sold my house in Providence and I got all these love letters. And it did, I did connect with and think of myself and see myself and some of the people who are sending the letters. And his quote was, I absolutely believe implicit and explicit bias could creep in through this use of love letters. That was John Marion.
Yeah. Well, here in Massachusetts, the Association of Realtors, they sent us a statement from their president saying that The group actually is strongly discouraging the use of love letters by realtors because of the potential to violate fair housing laws. So with all that said, Jonathan DiArojo, are you still encouraging your clients to use love letters?
Well, I suppose it depends on the situation. And much less so than in the past. I mean, there are a lot of listing agents that are discouraging. They're just outright saying in their listings, we're not interested in love letters. Do not include them with an offer. It comes down to the seller. Is the seller interested in knowing more about the buyer? Sellers oftentimes, they've been in these neighborhoods for decades. Their next door neighbors are their friends. Is there an opportunity for them to help discern, two offers that are otherwise comparable? How do I pick? I have people ask me that. How do I choose between these two offers? And I think having a little bit more information is a reasonable thing for the buyer to say, hey, I'd love to tell a little bit about my story, because this is a huge decision that you're making.
Absolutely. I mean, people put so much energy and money and effort into making their house what it is that, it can resonate that they'd want it to go to the right person. But I want to bring up a different point, sort of from the perspective of a seller receiving one of these letters. The letters could be fiction. In fact, I know of a few cases, people who sold to straw buyers, so people who received letters that were completely made up, only to see the house get bulldozed or used for a commercial purpose. So I guess this is a question for you, Ed. How can you tell if love letters are even true?
That's an excellent point, because when I wrote the story, I heard about a situation where someone kind of suggested in a letter that we might be having a kid soon, and that child has not arrived, so that didn't happen. So yeah, how do you can't tell if it's all legitimate, and you can't fact check some of it. So it's an excellent question, and on the other side, it's part of a bigger picture where there's a huge racial gap when it comes to home ownership.
That's right.
I think 72% of white Americans own their own homes, 48% for Latinos, Black Americans, 42%. And, part of that is lending practices, generational wealth, things like that. But love letters is part of it, is the argument for this legislation.
Right, right. Well, that's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. Well, Jonathan DiArojo, realtor with the Vantage Point team in Lexington, thank you so much for joining us, as well as Ed Fitzpatrick, a reporter for the Boston Globe covering Rhode Island. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thousands of veterans currently seek medical care at the Central Western Mass Veterans Administration Medical Center in Northampton. But that could change. The Federal Department of Veterans Affairs has recommended closing the facility. Essentially, a nationwide study has identified the facility as needing more than $120 million in repairs and serving a population that's moving to other locations. Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern represents the Commonwealth's 2nd District. He held a town hall last night where veterans sounded their concerns.
We're in a time when it's harder to fill your car. I don't see how asking people to travel further for care that was promised to them when they signed their lives away fits in with that sort of mission.
To lose this VA here is regrettable.
Let's be frank. It's a slap in the face of veterans here.
We caught up with Congressman McGovern last hour, and I started by asking him about what he heard from veterans and employees at the town hall last night.
I heard a lot of stories, including many veterans who stood up and said that if it wasn't for the VA facility in Leeds, they probably wouldn't be alive today. And I know it was very, very powerful. We get inundated with facts and figures and statistics, And I think sometimes we lose our human ability to feel what they mean. But hearing firsthand from these veterans, men and women who got up and talked about how meaningful this facility is, how they receive quality care, how they still get care there, and how they don't know what they would do if it were eliminated. I thought it was very, very moving. You wouldn't be human if you weren't moved by that. And my determination to do everything I can, working with our delegation, to make sure that that facility is not closed, you know, has only intensified.
Right. You made the comment that $100 million has recently been invested in the Northampton VA facility, with more money in the pipeline, right?
That's correct. And what was really really puzzling to me is that the firm that, you know, put this recommendation together, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, talked about the fact that the facility needed, you know, over $100 million in upgrades to meet VA facilities. What it didn't say was that that money was already invested, and there's more money to be invested in this facility. So if you were to shut it down, you might as well flush that money down the toilet. I mean, it was like, why was that omitted? So I think there was a terrible error made by the people on the commission that put this recommendation forward. And I want to talk to the Secretary of the VA directly about this, our entire delegation, virtually everybody in the delegation, including our two senators, Senator Warren and Markey, you know, joined with me in urging the Secretary to basically end this process with regard to the Leeds facility. And I hope that he does, but there is no way, there's no way this should be closed. There's no rationale for it. It makes absolutely no sense.
Right. So Representative Moulton, Seth Moulton, who's obviously an authority on veterans issues, said in a recent statement that, and I'm quoting here, as someone who gets my own health care through the VA, I know how important it is for services to be accessible. But this is the beginning of a long process, Moulton says, and it's important to let the VA make their case before Congress weighs in. Is he wrong there? Why didn't he join the letter criticizing the decision that the rest of the delegation did?
And I disagree with him respectfully for this reason. The case that is being put forward is missing things like the fact that over $100 million has just been recently invested in the facility. I mean, try and give me a break. I mean, this facility has received the upgrades. There's more to come. And by the way, the veterans in Western Massachusetts who desperately rely on this facility for care, where are they going to go? They're going to drive to Boston? I mean, some of these veterans that spoke up yesterday are in their 80s or older. And, you know, it's difficult for them to get, you know, to get to places that are far away. I mean, they won't get the care. And again, I heard over and over and over again from veterans yesterday that if they have to drive, you know, to Connecticut or even to Springfield, quite frankly, from some of the hill towns in which many of them come from, they just won't get the care. Look, we owe our veterans better than this, and there is no justification for this to even be on any list. And quite frankly, what is stunning to me is that the recommendation omits so many important facts and so many important investments that have already been made.
And you're actually taking the VA to task on this, saying that they don't have the right data before them, right?
Right, they don't. They don't. I mean, they don't. I mean, again, we're looking at, you know, at the recommendation that has been put forward, and they talk about the need for these investments that have already been made. They don't say that the investments have been made. Mm. Taxpayers should be outraged at the prospect that after all this investment, this recent investment, that anybody is talking about potentially closing this facility.
Congressman, as you noted, this is a potential closure. It's not, there's no set date at this point for the facility in Northampton to be shuttered. But you really want to snuff this out from the get-go before it gets on track.
I do, because they don't have a case. Again, there's major information, there's important information that wasn't even acknowledged in the recommendation that's gone forward. Look, I mean, there is a process, you know, that you know, this has to go through. And so we're very much at the beginning of it. But, I mean, given what it was omitted, given the really poor work that was put into this recommendation, I really do think that the Secretary of the VA should say this shouldn't even be on the table for consideration.
Do you have an appointment to meet with him yet? Is that planned?
I have a call in to him. And again, the testimonies that we heard last night, I have a recording and we're transcribing it. He will get all of that so that he can hear firsthand from these veterans.
Okay.
And as I said, you know, these veterans deserve a hell of a lot better. And we're going to be wind at their back. We're going to fight to keep this open.
Right. Changing gears a bit. So one of the hospitals out near the Northampton VA is Cooley Dickinson. And that's one possible place where the vets who currently go to the facility in Northampton would or could seek care. I know you heard from Jeff Harness. He's a community relations officer at that hospital. He was at the event last night. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
We are not necessarily the place that best understands their unique needs. And that place, in fact, is the VA Medical Center.
Yeah, so that certainly resonates with what you're trying to stand up for.
Right, and I think he would acknowledge, and everybody who's outside the VA system would acknowledge, the uniqueness of the VA system when it comes to healthcare. Treating people with health challenges that are unique to our veterans communities, from PTSD. Do we have a lot of veterans who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan who are suffering ailments from the burn pits that they were exposed to in those places? And so one of the important things about the VA is that it understands the population that they are treating. And, you know, we heard also from a lot of veterans that, you know, many of our Vietnam-era veterans who came back from Vietnam who were hesitant to go to the VA initially and had to be convinced to feel comfortable to go to the facility to be able to talk about their experiences and their health issues. And they got up and said, and thank God that we were convinced to do so because the care here is so specific and so unique. And they said this over and over and over again, that it literally saved their lives.
Right.
You know, that ought to matter.
Well, I think everybody can agree that we want what's in these vets' best interests. But it's not like this recommendation from the VA to close the Northampton facility came completely out of nowhere. You know, it's a broader initiative to modernize the VA, which, again, I think most people can agree on in principle. The chief of the VA, Dennis McDonough, said that across the system, the changes would mean nearly 150,000 more vets will have primary care within 30 minutes. 200,000 more vets will have mental health care within 30 minutes. And in a modern state-of-the-art facility that the veterans deserve. Those are McDonough's words. Congressman McGovern, what's your response to that?
I would simply say that if you shut down this facility, your promise will not be kept, because where do these veterans go to get the kind of specialized care that they're getting at the facility at Leeds? Where do they go? They drive to Connecticut? Where do they go? No one is suggesting that we don't modernize, you know, our facilities. And by the way, that's what the over $100 million in investments in this facility was all about, bringing it up to the standards that the VA says they want all of their hospitals and medical facilities to be able to adhere to. So the investments have been made. The standards are up to where they need to be. And if you shut this down, I mean, tell me, where does somebody who lives in, you know, Conway or Leiden or, you know, Goshen or Northampton go to? They're not going to be within a half hour distance for the kind of care that they currently get there. So, yeah, we want that to be the case, where every veteran is no more than a half an hour away from getting the kind of care they need. But you shut this facility down, you're breaking your promise.
Okay. Well, that's U.S. Representative Jim McGovern. He represents Massachusetts' 2nd District, which includes Worcester, Northampton, and Amherst. Congressman McGovern, thanks for being with us today.
All the best. Be safe.
Okay. Listening in on that conversation was the mayor of Northampton, Gina Louise Shara. Mayor Shara, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here to talk about this crucial fight we have to keep the Leeds VA Center here in Northampton open.
Okay, so first of all, I'll give you the field to react to everything the congressman just said.
Well, I mean, I want to say that Northampton is so grateful for our partners at the state level in the Western Mass delegation, and we had a very strong show of support last night at the listening session. And I'm especially grateful to Congressman McGovern, who's leading the charge at the federal level with Senators Warren and Markey and other members of Congress from the Commonwealth. It was a very powerful event that we had last night. And, you know, I think that the congressman stated very well that this recommended proposal of closing the center in Leeds is wrong on many levels. Economically, the report is flawed, as he said. It doesn't take into account the investments that have already been made or the ones that are planned, hundreds of millions of dollars. But I think more importantly, maybe it doesn't take into account the true, real human costs that would be suffered, including the veterans who would not access care because of increased travel or lack of transportation, or because a facility in a bigger urban area just doesn't fit the needs that they have and doesn't provide the same peace that the facility in beautiful Leeds does.
So I take it that you don't agree with the VA's conclusion that the veterans population is moving and that someplace in the vicinity of Springfield would more effectively serve these folks.
No, I don't agree. And we know directly from the veterans. We heard them say this last night, and I've been hearing from them since this report came out, that there are many who would not feel able to travel. And so they would not get the care that they need. And as Congressman McGovern said, the VA in Leeds has saved so many lives, both with health care and with mental health care. And it would be really sacrificing many veterans who would not be able to make a trip to a different location.
Yeah. If you could talk a little bit about the economy out there, Northampton. How big of an employer is this facility, and what kind of secondary effects would its closing have?
Oh, it would have a devastating effect on our economy. It is a significant facility and employs many, who reside in Northampton, but also in the region. It is a major draw. It also has an impact on our economy in terms of you have families that come and visit people there. And so there are people who end up staying in Northampton and being part of our sort of tourist economy because it is such an important facility that's here. So it would have a huge impact on us.
Okay. So one of the arguments from the VA is that surrounding healthcare facilities would be able to absorb some of the folks who now seek care at the VA facility. If you could talk a little bit about the healthcare, the broader healthcare sector in Northampton and their ability to take on the additional patients.
Well, I mean, you in the segment with the congressman, you heard Jeff Harness from Cooley Dickinson, who we have a remarkable local hospital here. But as Jeff said, they don't specialize in veterans care. It's a really special kind of healthcare. And actually for me last night, it was incredibly powerful to hear from female vets. Multiple women spoke and said that the Leeds facility is a place that excels at care for women who are veterans. And they really poignantly expressed that before getting care there, they felt that their needs and their women's health issues as veterans weren't acknowledged or addressed elsewhere. It really was in Leeds that they felt acknowledged and that they were given the kind of care that they need, and they hadn't experienced that anywhere else. So, we do have wonderful hospitals, but as the congressman said, this is a very specialized kind of care, and we know that the Leeds Center does it exceptionally well, and particularly around mental health and post-traumatic stress. We have a psychiatric treatment program there that's one of the best in the country, and so that is very specialized care.
Right. So if you, Mayor Shara, had the magic wand to be able to fix this situation, to keep the facility in your community, what would your solution look like?
Well, I mean, I again agree with the congressman that I think this is, you know, we already have the solution. I think that this report is flawed and isn't accurate. And so, you know, I'm hopeful, you know, with all due respect to Congressman Moulton, this may be a long process, but I think this process needs to stop as soon as possible, because the report is built on what seems like inaccurate data, right? So it's not taking into account the investments that have already been made.
Right.
So I think that I would like this stopped. And I think that it's really important for the veterans, because this has been incredibly stressful for them to have this hanging over them.
Okay. Well, Gina Louise Shara, mayor of Northampton. Mayor Shara, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's not too often that we think about what's under our feet. You might picture the dirt or cement, but maybe the sewage pipes and electrical cables underneath. Worms, bugs, but what about metal? In New England, there's a whole thriving community of metal detector enthusiasts. And it makes sense. There's a ton of history to be found here. Lost trinkets, war mementos, pieces from a distant past. It's a way to connect with the ancestors. And there's no end to what you might find if you know where to look. One of these metal detector aficionados joins us now, Jeremiah Ferris. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. So I feel like Absolutely. I feel like one of the risks of talking about this on the show is that we're going to get new people interested in joining the metal detecting community. Is that new competition for you, or are you always looking to get more people into the hobby?
I've always said I'd love to see a lot more people get into the hobby. It's a really bad stereotype that it's an old man hobby. And there's younger and younger people starting to do it every day.
Okay. So plenty of people have unique hobbies, myself included, but I don't know anybody who does metal detecting. What's your day job and how did you get turned on to metal detecting?
During the day, I work for the DPW here in my town, East Longmeadow. It was just before COVID. I mean, I had done it a little bit when I was a little kid, you know, like a $10 Radio Shack metal detector, and just really didn't get into it because it was just in my yard. But then just before COVID, I was watching a lot of YouTube videos of these guys doing it and watching them pull amazing things out of the ground. And I was just like, I'm going to try that. And just happened to know a guy in my local town that has a lot of land, and the land ended up being really historical. And I just started pulling all these insane finds out of the ground, and that was it. I was hooked. It was game over from there.
Okay. Well, we'll get to some of your finds, but you're from Western Mass, but mm-hmm. people go all over for metal detecting. What's the best spot for it locally, you know, here in Massachusetts? Or is that something you like to keep to yourself?
I do tell people who start off, try local parks, make sure that it's allowed. Usually on their websites, it'll say whether or not it's allowed, or you can just simply ask permission. Try to look for old homes in your towns and simply door knock and ask permission. The worst they can say is no. I do a ton of research to find the places where I go. You gotta swing over it pretty much.
Right. Right. You gotta try your luck, I can imagine. And sometimes you probably don't always, you know, hit a home run. When some people picture metal detecting, like you said, the stereotype might be an old man, you know, waving a beeping thing around on a beach, finding bottle caps. But you're quite strategic about where you go and what you're looking for. So what goes into picking the right spot and planning a search?
Let me just clear this up. I try to be strategic.
Okay, got it.
I search old maps, and we'll cross-reference them to newer maps and see if there's still land there or if it's in fact been built over. Read old books for, you know, the surrounding towns and stuff, and sometimes it'll be just a simple reference that there was a general store here and now it's a field. So then you just got to find out who owns it and find phone numbers or door knock, like I said, and that's how it begins.
Okay. Interesting. So one thing, whenever I see somebody with a metal detector, which isn't often, I must admit, but when I do, I wonder what they're finding, what they have found. So I'm curious to ask you for some of your best finds. So I have a few questions here, but first up,
sure.
First big find, what was it?
First big find would be early 1700s, fully intact colonial shoe buckle. Most of the time they come just the frame, like the square frame.
Mm.
But this had what they call a tongue in shape. So it had the two pieces to the buckle that actually hold the boot on your foot. So okay. It was the fully intact shoe buckle. And I just couldn't believe I dug it. It was literally 15 feet off the road in my hometown here at a restaurant. So it's like, you know, how did this 1700 shoe buckle stay in the ground for that long in the front yard of a popular restaurant?
Unbelievable. I mean, that it's preserved for so long. So your most valuable find, what would that be?
That would be an like 1620, 1630, what they call as a Stuart button. And it was a button that was made for when they beheaded King Charles I. And it's, if you look at it, it was made for the martyred king. So they made these buttons. It's like a crystal, and the backing of it is sterling silver. But underneath the crystal on the front face is gold wire that they would make initials or something to remember the king by.
Well, fascinating stuff.
About
Jeremiah.
1636.
1636.
Yeah.
So many centuries ago. Fascinating stuff. Thanks for bringing it to Radio Boston and telling us about your metal detecting adventures.
Thanks for having me again. It was great.
Jane Lynch is a comedian, singer, and an Emmy Award-winning actress. You may know her from films like Best in Show and The 40-Year-Old Virgin, but she's best known for portraying Sue Sylvester, the ruthless cheerleading coach on Fox's musical TV show, Glee.
I know my methods are extreme. I know I'm not like the rest of you hippies, caring about the kids' feelings as if they're real.
While Jane Lynch has had an eclectic career on the silver and small screen, she's also no stranger to the stage. In 2013, she made her Broadway debut as Miss Hannigan in the beloved classic Annie. And this weekend, Lynch is starring in the first ever Broadway revival of the musical Funny Girl, a biographical show about the Broadway and vaudeville star Fanny Brice that launched a young Barbra Streisand into international fame in 1964. Lynch will be appearing in the role of Fanny Brice's mother, Rosie. Back in June of 2019, we got to catch up with Lynch herself as she was preparing for a performance with the Boston Pops, singing her favorite songs from the American Songbook. At the time, former Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell met with Jane Lynch at Symphony Hall. She shared the interview with host Tiziana Deering, which began with Lynch explaining how she first got into singing.
Well, I am the daughter of Frank Lynch, Frank and Eileen Lynch, and we are a singing family. And my parents loved to sing, and they loved to harmonize. And I grew up with music. My father always had a song in his heart, on his lips, and he sang all day long around the house, and I do that myself. Anybody who spends 5 minutes with me would know that that's who I am. I've always loved doing performing, and it's only in the last 6 or 7 years that I've been doing it like on a touring basis.
Did the Boston Pops approach you about this performance, or how did this
come
together?
No, I approached them, my agent, you know, to be specific, but yeah, I wanted to perform here. I remember the Pops from when I was growing up. I remember watching Arthur Fiedler on television, and it always looked like so much fun, the 4th of July celebrations. It's just, it's Americana, and I love it.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear, you know, I feel like so many people have done their own renditions. Like, mm-hmm. there's Rod Stewart, Lady Gaga, mm-hmm. I feel like is a recent one, Aretha Franklin. You know, what does a Jane Lynch, Brad Ellis interpretation sound like? How do you even start to develop that?
Well, Brad has his own style, but it's also respectful of every style of music there is because he has mastered every style of music there is. So we combine styles sometimes in different songs. We're doing this song called Boo Hoo, which is from... Guy Lombardo, who I know is a Canadian, don't pick nuts with me. And Brad has kind of taken it from kind of the traditional bum, bum, ba-da-dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, and taken it kind of into a ballad for a little ways there. And we do a medley of, we call smoky sad songs. And, you know, it's kind of a depressing medley of love gone wrong. We kind of stay true to the style there, but you really see when you hear all of these songs together how sad and emotionally draining they can be.
Can you tell me, and obviously we don't want to reveal every single song in the show, but are there any that have a particular significance to you that you're performing tonight or any reason you chose any of these?
I open with Lazy, Hazy, Crazy Days of Summer, which was a Nat King Cole hit in 1963, and it may be perhaps my first musical memory. It was a favorite song of my father's, and we loved summer growing up. Like in the 60s, summer was all about going on vacation with the family, loading up the station wagon and singing and, you know, going to the beach, and that's a song that celebrates that very American thing that I don't know that folks do anymore. Maybe they do, I don't know, but I just love that about the summer.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of sodas and pretzels and beer. Roll out.
And also the Boo Hoo, which is a song that I don't even know that my parents knew I was aware of.
Boo Hoo, that's why I'm crying for you. One day you'll feel like I do, and you'll be boo-hoo-hooing too.
I listened to it on a 78 in my grandmother's, on her old Victrola record player. And I would play it over and over again. I thought it was a wonderful song when I was a kid. And I also did this song called A Letter from Camp. It's an Alan Sherman song, and it's really hilarious. And it's, hello, Mutta, hello, Fada, here I am at Camp Granada. And I remember loving that song when I was growing up.
What did you love about it?
It rhymed, and it was funny, and it was about a kid who was at camp who just wanted to go home. He hated it.
Darling Fada, lovely Mutta, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I will even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, I also am a fan of a lot of these songs. I'm a big mm-hmm. musical person, Pence, Glee, etc. What do you think it is about these American songs that make them so kind of timeless? Like, they never feel like they go out of style. They always feel new.
Yeah, they're musically very simple. And they're melody driven, and they're written to a basic formula, and they're very satisfying. I'm going to sound like an old lady now, kids these days, but there's kind of a satisfying simplicity with a well-formed pop song that follows a particular recipe. There's beautiful rhymes, and the lyrics in some of the songs I'm singing are like poetry. So that's what I love about it, and that's why I think these songs will endure.
I'd love to ask you, you mentioned your connection to this music started with your family, mm-hmm. and I was reading some of the songs tonight are definitely a tribute to your father. You mentioned mm-hmm. Hazy, Crazy Days of Summer. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you think it would mean to him that you're doing this here?
Oh, I was just saying that out there. It's just, he would be thrilled to death. He would die all over again. he would just love this show. And I say in the beginning, this is basically a show inspired by my father. I found that the music that was first and foremost in my mind when I thought of what would I like to perform was all the stuff my dad used to sing around the house. And he would just love it. My mother, who is also not with us anymore, would love it too. I'm from a family of they came together on music, my mom and dad. They're not professional, but they would sing in the bars in Chicago. They met in a bar on the south side of Chicago, and they knew all the pop songs, and they harmonized. My dad had a beautiful tenor. And I remember my mother, toward the end of her life, she had a carotid artery, and they nicked her vocal cord. And she couldn't sing anymore. And that depressed her more than anything. And I was always so sad for her because she loved to sing in church, and now she had to switch octaves all the time, and it upset her greatly not to be able to sing.
That's singer, comedian, and actress Jane Lynch speaking with Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell, who joins me now in the studio. Hi, Zoe.
Hello.
Zoe, it is great to hear about her connection with the American Songbook and hear those tunes, but Jane Lynch has had a pretty varied career, hasn't she?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah. She's done tons.
Yeah, and a wide variety of film, movie, television, et cetera.
Yeah, and so she was most recently, too, on this episode of Arthur last month, PBS's Arthur. There was an episode where there was a same-sex wedding ceremony, which kind of was a big deal. And in it, Arthur's teacher, Mr. Ratburn, marries an aardvark named Patrick. His students all attend. And Jane Lynch got to voice his sister, who performed the ceremony. And this episode was this quiet nod to the LGBTQ community. And I got to ask her about what it really meant for her to be a part of that.
So I think it was really lovely how they did it. I thought it was touching, and the wedding was so great with the kids, and I think it was just a lovely thing. It didn't waving gay pride banners or anything like that. It was very quiet and simple and quite normal in the context in which it was presented. It's just, oh, isn't that wonderful? He found love.
Finally, you know, you've obviously had this long career. You've done a lot of different things, comedy, music, acting, performing. What would be your advice to young performers of any kind?
Just do what makes you feel good. You know, I never set out to be a singer or someone who does symphony shows. I didn't set out to even do like television. I really just wanted to, the opportunity to be on stage. And I couldn't have designed my career. I mean, my expectations for it would have fallen far below what actually happened. But I just really show up, and I say yes to just about everything, and except porn. And no one's asked me to do porn yet. But, you know, the answer will be no. I just want to get that out there right now. The answer will be no. Yeah, I just basically did anything that felt good. And singing felt really right and great in the last couple of years. King of
the road. That was the multi-talented and funny performer Jane Lynch, speaking with former Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell back in 2019. Jane Lynch stars in the first ever Broadway revival of Funny Girl on Sunday, April 24th. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Simone Rios. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.